Welcome to Life List, a birding podcast.
Well, hello, hello, hello. This is George Armistead, and you're listening to Life List, a birding podcast. Okay, it's not George. It's me. It's Alvaro. I just wanted to pretend I was George for a few minutes, seconds, to highlight the point that I'm actually doing this one alone. Molly's not here either. And it's a different model for our podcast because I've wanted to, over time, develop some podcasts that are about bird science. And thinking about papers and things that have been published or people talking about, and sometimes maybe have a guest, sometimes even talk through some of these things with George and Molly, but sometimes just have me do it on my own. You know, I sometimes just need a little space. And that's what this one is. And I want to say it goes back to the fact that when I was a young birder, I used to read Birding Magazine, the ABA's magazine. And they had a column there by Paul De Benedictis called Gleanings from the Technical Literature. And I really enjoyed that column. And I learned a lot about science. Mostly it was about taxonomy, and got excited about some of those topics from the perspective of a birder, yet eventually I became a scientist. And I thought, well, here we have this venue where we are chatting about birds, and why not every so often do a little gleanings of my own? And hopefully it'll spark some kind of interest in some of these things with you, and you can look deeper into it. In today's world, with Google and other search engines' ability to even download papers from directly from the authors on sites such as ResearchGate, for example, if you haven't tried that, it's cool. You can be following specific authors in science and get their papers and so forth. In any case, I wanted to do that. I'm also right now in India, northern India. We are finishing up in the next few days an amazing tour that we just did, my first time in India, and have seen all sorts of great birds. But I got to mention that it is freezing cold here. I have a suitcase that has like several shorts and little short socks and stuff, you know, for me to wear on the field that have not seen the light of day. In fact, I'm wearing every day every single layer that I own because it is so cold here. I am freezing my chapatis off, if you know what I mean. And it is a little unexpected. I know we were in India in winter, but it is a particularly cold and foggy winter here in India. In any case, we have seen some amazing stuff, and we'll probably talk about it on an upcoming podcast. Today, we saw an Asian elephant, which was sort of bird of the day for me, although the crested tree swift was also a cool one that I was excited about seeing. One bird I have seen in India that is wintering here and is always a bird I enjoy seeing is the ruff. Now, if you've never seen a ruff, it is, first of all, cool because it's a one-word bird name, and a lot of one-word bird names are birds that are of particular interest for some reason or well-known. And the ruff is a sandpiper, so it's not called ruff sandpiper, just the ruff. And it has a unique situation in its name in that it is sometimes referred to as the ruff, and sometimes the ruff is only for the male, and the female is giving a separate name, the reeve. So ruff and reeve. So they have two different names, although the official species name is ruff. If you've ever heard of the reeve, it is actually a female ruff. One of the reasons that these two the sexes have two different names is that because the male is so much bigger than the female, even in non-breeding times, you can see this real difference and you can spot them in the field and say, oh, there's a male, there's a female, because of such a big difference in size. You also, in the breeding season, will see incredible differences between the male plumage and the female plumage. That's not all that unusual in a lot of birds, even sandpipers, but the ruff males vary big time. It almost seems like no two males are the same, and I'm going to get into this in a little bit. But the ruff is a shorebird that breeds from Europe to Asia in the far north, so Arctic, you know, and taiga-type habitats. They migrate down south, so they're found in winter in Africa and commonly in India, where I am now, as well as Southeast Asia. So it's really a shorebird that's widely distributed in the old world. And because it's such a long-distance migrant, it gets lost, and it becomes a vagrant commonly, or maybe sometimes not so commonly, in the New World. The odd thing about the distribution of, well, let's put it this way. One odd thing about ruffs is that in the New World, they have been seen at times in little groups of males as if they might be displaying and perhaps nesting in North America somewhere. And I think those situations have been seen in Alaska, maybe. But I do know that in Churchill, Manitoba, it happened once. But there's never been, as far as I know, proven breeding in North America. Yet it is one of the most widespread of the shorebird vagrants from the old world in the new world. There are lots and lots of ruff records all over the U.S. and Canada, as far south as Argentina and Brazil, and perhaps Uruguay. I'm not sure, but a few records in the south. They're probably being missed. Many of them likely are in places where people are not birding. But I would say that almost every state and province, territory in Canada has had a ruff record. They are less common in the interior, sort of Great Plains, more commonly found on the West Coast and east of the Mississippi River. So actually relatively frequently found in the Midwest and Great Lakes. So it's an interesting bird from like sort of a rare bird perspective, and that, you know, ruff could show up any old place that you're birding in the U.S. and Canada, and maybe even further south, yet it's not one of our birds. The ruff is a sandpiper, as I mentioned before, and in the past it was given its own genus, but now it is in the genus Calidris that includes most of the sandpipers. The sandpipers that you typically think of, like the Pepys and the Dunlin, Sanderling, all of those kinds of sandpipers, sharp-tailed, etc. Within that group, that is the classic Calidris group, it is sort of the one on the outside. So it would sort of like what we call the sister group to the main group of classic sandpipers. So it is a sandpiper. It is somewhat divergent from them, but within the group. So you could argue whether it gets its own genus or not, but you know, right now it has been subsumed into Calidris. Yet it is like no other sandpiper there is, partially because of how variable it looks in the breeding plumage. Also, it is different in how it behaves. And I should describe that there are a lot of different breeding systems that happen in shorebirds in the north, and all sorts of shenanigans are going on. You have birds that are, you know, displaying in arenas in leks to other species. There are things called exploded leks. There are species where the male does all the parental care, species where the male has no does no care at all at the nest, like in the ruff. And shorebirds, and in particular the sandpiper group, has some of the most diverse set of breeding systems within one group of birds that we know of, okay? Within that, the ruff is a lekking species. And if you've heard of a lek, it's that classic scenario that you might imagine if you've never seen it, of like prairie chickens or sage grouse, where all of these males are in a confined region, a display ground, and they're all displaying, trying to look cool. And the females come in and they sort of go, well, I don't know about you. Maybe you're okay, what have you. And they mate with one male. They might come back the next day and mate with a separate male. But many of the males in that lekking system actually don't get to mate. There are few males that actually perform most of the matings, most males that don't get, perform any matings, or very few. That system is called the lek, and it's a polygynous system, so males tend to mate with multiple females. In fact, females may mate with multiple males, so you could actually call it a polygamous system entirely. The word lek means playground, and it's in one of the Scandinavian languages, and it comes from the ruff. The ruff was the first bird that people saw and thought, look at these crazy things. They're going about something wacky. They're having like this sort of playground of display, and they called it a lek. Now we use that word lek for all sorts of things, including their fish leks, insect leks, all sorts of things that lek. And that is when you have these males displaying to females in a united sort of small area and kind of doing a little dance or something, that they are trying to attract the attention of the females in order to mate. So they're a lekking species. Now, within that lek, the males look crazy, right? So these ruffs in the winter plumage, where I've been seeing them here in India, are brownish. They have sort of pale fringes to the upper part feathers. Some of them are a little pale bill. Some have a dark bill. They have a little dark spot, or well, sort of a stripe behind the eye that gives them a really distinctive face, because they don't have much else of a face or neck pattern. It's just this little dark, tiny stripe behind the eye, almost like a, like, you know, the Egyptians used to draw that line behind their eyes and so forth. It looks like that. And they molt into a breeding plumage where the males get a fluffy, long set of feathers, like a mane around the neck. In fact, that is the ruff. They also get these long feathers on the head that look like kind of ears. And they grow long, long scapulars, the back feathers, that kind of drape over everything. And then when they display, they will sometimes just sort of make that ruff go all, flare, and then they'll turn their head back and kind of show the underside of the feathers. And also that the face is unfeathered and has all of these little red or yellowish spots on the face. That's unusual. And sometimes they have an orangey bill, sometimes they have a black bill. The ruff itself can be reddish, black, barred, kind of mottled, just all over the place. And I mean, what bird does that? What bird is so variable that you it's almost like barnyard chickens. You know, they look crazy. And yet this is out there in nature. So that was the first thing that attracted a lot of biologists, that are interested in behavior. You've got a lekking species. They're outlandish looking. They're highly variable. And then people started realizing that within that variety, there is one pattern that seemed to be more common than others. And it was a ruff that was white on the neck. The neck ears were white. They call these white ruffs. And I'll kind of get to what this means in a little bit. But that was sort of the main part of the start of rough work. And over time, as people started looking at them in their breeding areas up in the north, they realized that the males that are doing the regular lekking behavior are pretty standard. They're sitting in specific areas within the lek. They're displaying when the females come. They, you know, will sometimes fight with each other. In fact, in Spanish, their name is combatiente, which means combatants. And so they're in their little combat thing, dancing, doing their thing. But that the white ruffs did not act exactly the same as the typical independent ruffs. So we're going to call the classic common form that does the lekking the independence. Then these white ruffs would often kind of hang around a little bit more in the periphery. They would sometimes kind of befriend an independent and sort of be kind of like a wing ruff. And as a pair, they had more success attracting females. And those white ruffs would mate sometimes, and the independents would mate sometimes. And when you measured them and looked at them, those white ruffs were smaller, a little smaller than the independents. They were given a different name, the satellites. And we had independents and satellites. And there was a start back in the day of figuring out that there was some genetics to all this and that there was correlation between how they looked and how they acted, right? So that was key. The white ruffs did not act like the classic independent ruffs. And then further on in people studying ruffs, they realized that there was a third type of male. The third type of male looks like a female. It is actually smaller again, and it doesn't get all the fancy looking color. It's more brownish and kind of subdued in its coloration like a female. And the males mistake it for a female. They may even try to mate with that male, which we call now a fader, F-A-E-D-R. And that fader male is really a female mimic. So we have three different types of ruffs, and those female mimics will, in fact, the fader males will mate every so often with a female and are successful in passing on their genes a certain amount of the time. Satellites make up about 5% of the male population. Faders make up about 1% of the male population, so they're actually quite rare. And they're all interacting in this sort of world of ruffs. When the classic work was being done on the genetics of this system, they found out that satellites and faders were dominant, let's call them genes, in the Mendelian genetic sense. So if you remember back in school, Mendel did all those experiments with peas and so forth, and he found that some genes acted very simply in that if you had a certain form of the gene, it would be dominant over the recessive form of the gene. So the expression of the dominant type would always show up when you had the dominant with the dominant or with the dominant with the recessive. Those two would show up and look like the dominant type only if you had the two recessives, would you then, in fact, be able to show the recessive form or phenotype? That's the phenotype is what things look like, act like, and so forth. So the two that are uncommon, faders and satellites, are actually the dominant version of this, let's call it gene. What is also unusual is that if you have the two fader genes within an individual, you know, egg, or the two satellite genes within an egg, those individuals do not hatch. They die. So this is something that is called being a recessive lethal. So you can only be a satellite or a fader if you have, from either your mom or your dad, the satellite gene and the independent gene for a satellite, or the fader gene and then the independent gene for a fader. If you have both independents or both faders, you don't survive. It's kind of crazy. One thing that we don't know much about is that these actual gene types are present in the females, and whether that affects the behavior or choices or what happens within the females, that's kind of the next step in figuring out how all of this works. But it's harder to do. So we have this crazy situation. We know it's genetic. We know that it's got this dominance effect. But in modern days, they've been able to figure out quite a lot more about what is going on in the roughs. And there was a paper, it was in 2015, I want to say, and by Sanjit Lamich-Haney, that was called Structural Genomic Changes Underlie Alternative Reproductive Strategies in the Rough. And what it discovered was that the different types of male roughs were coded by something that we now call a supergene. So a supergene is essentially a cluster of genes that control complex traits, and they are passed on kind of like a unit. So if you get the supergene that says, I'm a fader, that's something, and versus the supergene that might say, I'm just a classic, regular old independent male. And the supergenes are, in the recent past, been understood to be really important in coding for or creating some wacky situations within animals. And here's a couple of examples, right? We kind of now know that migration in trout, for example, like let's say rainbow trout, they come in the lake versions versus the migratory versions called steelhead. And the steelhead look different, have different size, different, all sorts of different ecology, but they're still rainbow trout. They're in the same species. They share genes, to some extent with the greater rainbow trout population, but that is a supergene that's controlling the migration and lifestyle of trout. White-throated sparrows are a really good example. If you've looked at the field guide, you know that white-throated sparrows in the breeding season especially come in a white stripe and a tan stripe morph. And morphs are not that unusual in birds, but white-throated sparrows have morphs that are correlated with behavior. White-throated sparrows that are white stripes tend to be more territorial. White-throated sparrows that are tan stripes tend to be less territorial and devote more time and energy to nesting and raising the young. Now, and this is not related to sex. So you can be a white striped male or you can be a white striped female. White striped females are just more territorial than tan striped females, similarly in the males. In fact, when they mate, when everything's going on up in the North Woods, white striped males of the sparrows will mate with a tan stripe, and vice versa, like a white striped female will mate with a tan striped male, because you want to balance out the aspects of territoriality and versus nesting and nest care and so forth. So that complex situation of color and behavior is governed by a supergene, a chunk of genes that gets passed on as a unit. And another new example of this is in the red poles. People have been arguing for years whether red poles were, the hoary red pole and the common red pole were all the same species. They sound similar. They kind of look similar, except hoary red pole is, you know, fluffier, bigger, shorter build, whiter in plumage, nests farther north, and they just look like a different thing than a common red pole. But it turns out that being a hoary red pole versus a common red pole is governed by a supergene, and that supergene is passed on and expressed in different ways in the north versus the south. So the red poles are a population that is mixing genes and they're breeding with each other. There's no barrier in the genetics of common versus hoary red pole. Essentially, they're morphs that have differences in not only in color, but in morphology, shape and size, as well as maybe even behavior. So I can tell you in the future, I think we're going to see a lump in the two species of red poles, and we're going to understand that their differences are due to a supergene rather than through a difference in the gene pool of the north and the south divided by a section where they don't hybridize or what have you. That's not what's going on. It's a supergene, and the birds are fluidly interbreeding, and it's expressing a different northern population, hoary, versus a southern population, common. So these supergenes are going to start showing up more and more as people study them, and they're going to explain why certain situations in the natural world have these polymorphisms, basically, you know, different morphs that are complicated and often even are differences not just in coloration, but structure, behavior, and all sorts of other things, right? One of the things about these supergenes, as they get to understand them more, is that in the chromosome, the genes are all stacked up, you know, different genes that do different things in different chromosomes. And the supergene acts as a unit because it appears that many of them are actually a chunk of genes within the chromosome that were flipped. Like you almost took a group of them and flip them within the chromosome so they're inversed. And that's called an inversion. And that inversion creates the situation by which they are coded for and passed on as a unit to the next generation. They also tend to recombine in a different different way, and they kind of I'll get to this in a little bit, but they're more likely to gather mutations than the average gene, because when in sexual reproduction, where you have the recombination and mixing of the two, the male and the female genes, or you know, the components that come from the mother or the father, you get a lot of errors that get fixed. But in the supergene, a lot of those errors don't get fixed because that doesn't recombine in quite the same way. And you can accumulate junk, let's call it, or mutations. So also in that paper that was done in 2015, they did find that they could identify some of the very specific genes within the supergene. And they don't know exactly how it all works, but one of the genes in there changes or converts the testosterone into a different form, into a less active form. So this could be why the behavior of the satellite males or the fader males is different from the classic independent males. There's another gene there that's MC1R that codes for coloration. So you can see then, okay, so we have one gene there that's changing the testosterone, another one's changing coloration, and there's various other ones that they haven't, you know, sort of understood yet that are essentially coding for this different type of male. Okay, so the other thing that they found out was, because you're thinking, okay, that kind of sort of makes sense. You have this super gene, but you have two weirdo different kinds of males, not just one. How does that happen? Well, the original inversion, when this happened way back and it sort of boom, went into the genetics of the rough, created the fader. The fader, the female mimic, is the older of the unique sort of male types within the rough. It is the older one. Then at some point later on, the satellite is created by a kind of a tweaking, a recombination of that original inversion that gets little messed around with in a couple of parts. And then the satellite comes out of that much more recently. But the estimated age of that inversion, the original like fader arrives in the population, is 3.8 million years ago, nearly 4 million years ago. That is super, super, super old. It is so old that it almost doesn't make sense. Because some species, entire species of Calidra sandpiper, are about that old. So it's almost saying like, gosh, that at the time that the fader arrived in the rough population, the rough might have not quite even have been the rough. It was something else. It's so long ago. But we're going to get to that. It might be sort of a one of the classic situation where there's more to it, and the real story is even more interesting than what you might think. It's estimated that the fader is about 740,000 years old, so much younger. And now, actually more recently, that's been reinterpreted in some newer genetics, and it might even be younger. But one of the things that really perplexed biologists about this whole thing, after understanding that the whole complex of males was created by this super gene, was that the super gene should have accumulated a lot more errors and mutations along the way, given that it's so old and it hasn't. And that's when there's this newer paper from last year by Jason Hill and his gang that included Lama Cheney, and it's called Low Mutation Load in a Super Gene Underpinning Alternative Male Mating Strategies in Rough. Low Mutational Load in a Super Gene. Kind of, that's the problem. Why? And to give you an idea, or maybe like to think about how this works, is if you have these super genes that aren't recombining in the same way as the regular gene, like let's just think about having white socks, okay? You have white socks, you put them in your birding boots, and you go out there in the mud and whatever, and they start getting dirty. And you go and wash them, and they clean up a little bit, but they don't get to fully clean, you know, as they were when you bought them. And they accumulate sort of sock wear, as you might think. Well, imagine that the classic genes that are recombining sexually are getting washed really regularly, and the super genes that are recombining in a different way that's not quite as efficient or common should get dirtier because they're not being washed as much as the average genes. So in the sock analogy, the question becomes, why are the rough super jeans so clean sock. They shouldn't be. They're 4 million-year-old socks, okay? And that's where this new work that they did gets pretty interesting, because there are various things that could be happening. But one of the possibilities, and the one that I think they really point to that could be the reason, is that although the lineage of that gene is old, it didn't arrive in the rough just 4 million years ago. It arrived much more recently in the rough. So, okay, how does that happen? Hybridization. It is actually a set of genes that came from another species. So the super gene that's in the rough, creating faders and so forth, may have come from another species of shorebird. And it got stuck in there through a sort of mass hybridization event. And in fact, that shorebird might not even be with us anymore. It might be extinct. And that is what might have happened. And you think, well, this is insane. How can that happen? And why do they even think this is possible? Well, let's go back to the white-throated sparrows. The white-throated sparrows, that super gene that's making for a tan stripe and a white stripe, when you look at the genetics of that super gene, it allies to some extent towards relatives of the white-throated sparrows, like the white crown and golden crown sparrows. And the suggestion is that it is a chunk of genetic code that got mixed up into the white throats from a hybridization event from another Zonotrichia crowned sparrow. So this stuff is not so insane the more that we start looking at genes. In fact, it may be more common that we think in much more mundane situations that may not show up so vividly as tan stripe and white stripe morph sparrows. Also, while we're at this sort of hybridization thing, if you kind of follow and have followed this for years, you might know that way back we had Jaegers and Skuas. And this is in North America, because they're all called Skuas in England. So our Jaeger is actually the Arctic Skua, like parasitic Jaeger's Arctic Skua, for example. So let's just think North America-wide. We had the big, bulky, brown, stripy things, and we call those Skuas. The more bicolored, slimmer, smaller species that had a long central tail feathers that either pointed or spoon-shaped were Jaegers. Now, that was clear-cut. They were both in different genera, so different genus for each one, because that made sense. Divide up that family into two genera, each one that's really sort of well-defined, big brown things, bulky, no central tail feathers, to smaller, slimmer central tail feathers, pale underparts in the pale morphs anyways, Jaegers. All made sense until they tried to figure out the relationships with the Skuas and Jaegers. They found that the Pomeran Jaeger, so a Jaeger, was more closely related genetically to the great Skua. So they said, you know what? The Pomeran Jaeger is actually a Skua, but it looks like a Jaeger, which makes no sense. Actually, it makes absolute. You could show kids pictures of Jaegers and Skuas, and they say, well, these are one type and this is the other type. But the genes were messing people up, because what actually was going on, if you took a wider view, now that we can do this with newer technologies that are cheaper and you can able sample wider genetic, even the entire genome of a creature, well, it turns out that the part that looked like the two were each other's closest relatives was actually a chunk of genes that were transferred from the Skuas to the Pomeran Jaeger through an old hybridization event. But the Jaegers are Jaegers. Pomeranes are Jaegers. They just happen to carry genes from way back when some of the Jaegers and Skuas are interbreeding, and they got passed on to the entire Pomeran Jaeger population. So they fixed in the Pomeranes, but they're actually great Skua genes. Hybridization happens a lot in birds, and often genes are stolen from one population to the other, and they might have a beneficial effect, or they may create complexity like we're seeing in the ruff or the white-crowned sparrows, white-throated sparrows. So that's what they think is going on, that the super gene may have come from another species at some point in the past, although that species is old, and that's why the genes in that part look really old. They may have actually shown up in the ruff much more recently, and in fact, they're cleaner socks than you would expect, because they're not actually 4 million. The ruff hasn't had them for 4 million years. Let's put it that way. They were cleaned and sent to the ruff much more recently by a very good cleaning service. So. This is pretty insane, and I think a couple of things are that I learned from looking into this is that we as birders are always trying to think about species, which one I can count, which one I can't count, are they hybrids there? You know, we look at this sort of classically binary form of life where it's like you either are a different species or you're not. You're kind of pure or you're hybrid. And the reality is that much of what goes on in the natural world, especially in the bird world, that I know it a little bit better than other parts of the natural world, there are genes that are flowing around. They're being passed from species to species. The whole process of speciation sometimes actually diverges and sometimes it collapses into one species. And we're seeing a snapshot of not just it's not a branching tree. It's almost like a tree with lianas hanging down and branches that come together like, you know, in a really complicated tropical tree that kind of mutate and come together and make all sorts of things that aren't classic branches, like those rubber trees or whatever you might see in a place like India, for example. So we look for the simplicity, but in fact it's more complicated, and the complexity is actually really beautiful. What's going on is insane. It's like a sci-fi movie, and we're living at a time where we can actually read people's work using techniques that weren't even invented 15 years ago to see aspects of the living world that were hidden to us. And while we could in the past know that there were multiple types of male ruffs, now we can begin to understand how it happened, how long it happened, how long ago it happened, and maybe even the elements within the genes that are making it happen. Next step, like I said, is maybe understanding what the females are doing, what's going on within the female behavioral system, because they're carrying these genes too. So there you go, the ruff, perhaps the most interesting bird in the world. I don't always talk about ruffs, but when I do, I do it while I'm in India. And I hope you enjoyed that, and we'll try to do some more of these science little tidbits here and there. And if you have really good ideas or papers that you think are particularly interesting, send them to us. You know, get on our LifeList website, send us a note, or on Facebook, etc. And let me know what your thoughts are on other ones that we can do, because I have real joy in reading these papers and trying to understand them. And I got to tell you, I've never done any of this genetics myself. I read about it. I try to understand it. There may be errors in what I told you about. Hopefully, it is roughly the story. And if there's a major fixing we can do, let us know, and we'll post all that too in the show notes. And we'll post the papers in the show notes as well. So, goodbye from India, where I continue to freeze my papadums here as I hope to get up tomorrow, 5 in the morning, get out on a safari drive, and maybe see a few new birds, show them to other folks on our group, and enjoy a great tour with our wonderful expert guide here, Ansar Khan, and his brother, Robin. And if you've are interested in birding India, look us up at Alvaro's Adventures, and we'll be doing other trips in the future. And also Bhutan is coming up. We're going to put that one up for late this year with Peter Burke. And Peter also has a Thailand trip that is a go right now in the spring. So alvarosadventures.com. And thanks so much. We will get back to you with two of us or three of us talking about our recent trips and other things that are going on in the birding world. So thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.